The nonprofit MBA purpose is to provide new business insights and fresh creative ideas for executive directors and their teams that will help them improve their organization. Here is your host, Stephen Halasnik.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Stephen Halasnik. I will be your host for today's Nonprofit MBA podcast, as I have been for the last 6 years. I think this is like the 300th episode. This is a very, very popular podcast. I'm really, I think we're in the top 1% of all podcasts, so I'm very proud of it. And it's great. I have so many great guests. I'm really, really just, I think if that's executive directors, board members, or staff, just listen to these guests. It's going to make you better. It's just really good. For those who don't know me, I'm co-founder of Financing Solutions, and we are the leading provider of lines of credit for nonprofits in the United States for the last 13 years. That's smaller nonprofits. And if you're interested in looking into a nonprofit for your organization, it's a very popular product. Please visit nonprofitmbapodcast.com. Again, nonprofitmbapodcast.com. Today, I am very excited to be speaking with Sean Hale from Nonprofit Nonprofit CFOs. And Sean has served a variety of nonprofits professionally since 1999. During his 20 years as a nonprofit employee, he made improvements that reduced waste, generated new revenue, boosted sales, or I should say staff productivity and morale, grew financial transparency, and shrank risk. In 2020, Sean founded Nonprofit CFOs, a 12-person team that helps small and medium-sized nonprofits ensure they have strong, effective financial management. Sean, welcome to today's Nonprofit MBA podcast.
Stephen, thank you so much for inviting me to be here with you. It's a real honor to get to appear on the podcast.
Thank you. We're glad you have you. You have such a great background for this podcast. And today we're going to be talking about it. It's a very generalized topic, but we're going to be drilling down into it, what your nonprofit should do about your accounting, what they should do, what they should know. It's a variety of different topics. So let me start off first by asking you, Sean, when people are bringing you on, your organization on, typically for, let's say, smaller nonprofits, typically what do you find that they're looking for?
You know, Stephen, it's a mix of things. So we're happy to work with any sort of organization, but certainly we found that some of them come to us and they have some urgency and they have some worries on their mind, because very often what happens with a small nonprofit is they have just one accountant slash administrator slash wearing a whole bunch of other hats kind of role. That person gets burnt out. It comes as a surprise to everybody. That person gives 2 weeks notice. It's probably December 15th, because that person is looking at year-end close, and that being the worst time of year for people in that chair, right? December and January are the two toughest months, and they're looking at being burnt out, looking at missing the holidays yet again while all of their friends and family are getting together and relaxing. And they just decide, I just can't do this anymore. And they give up and they walk away. And so every year we'll get a call around December 15th and like, hey, this just happened and can you help us out? And so some of the folks that we hear from, that's the situation they're in. And of course, we do our best to help them. It's always a lot easier to help an organization when they reach us before that happens. It just takes fewer hours. It's a whole lot easier to build stuff and to help them get stronger before that. And so we absolutely try to do a lot of fractional CFO placements as well. And that's where an organization has somebody with CFO level experience and strong nonprofit leadership experience in with them for 10, 20, 30 hours a month, what have you, to help provide that level of leadership expertise and strategic decision making, but without the cost of a full-time CFO. And if you're a $1, $2, $3, $5 million nonprofit, you may not need a full-time CFO yet, but that leadership and that experience can really help you take your organization to the next level. We'll do special projects. And there's the other thing I would mention we have started doing in the last couple of years is helping organizations with their indirect cost rate agreements. If you're a nonprofit and you get federal grants, the government will give you by default, they'll let you charge up to 10% to cover your indirect costs. But we know that the real indirect costs of running projects is much more likely to be 20, 30, 40%, sometimes even more. But to be able to get the government to pay the full cost of doing that project, including the indirect costs, you have to negotiate a rate with them. And so that's paperwork that we will help them out with. And it's that kind of paperwork that, while it's not rocket science, it is the kind of thing that if you're already an accounting department that is kind of overwhelmed, it's the kind of straw that can break the camel's back. And so whether it's because your team is just stretched thin already, or sometimes you just don't have the expertise on your team to do it, that's something that we found where we can relatively easily go in and add a lot of value for that nonprofit. And it can make a difference of sometimes millions of dollars a year for organizations in just getting that rate right.
I got so many questions. The first one is do you find that a accountant who doesn't have a lot of experience working with nonprofits can effectively manage the accounting work that is required?
Well,
I think the answer would be yes, but not when you're talking about the forms that you just talked about. But
yeah,
but I think size matters, right? But
yes, and yes, and let me ask you a question. What's your favorite kind of food if you're going to go out to eat? All right, and so would you go to like a place that specializes in meat and potatoes and expect them to do delicious fish for you?
Right, and I thought your answer would be no. There's different. There's a big difference. Honestly, I look at 990s all the time. So like I kind of look at them. I'm like, well, it's really not. It's not rocket science to figure out has to go where. Yeah. So let's go back to the original question. And that is, how is it different when an accountant knows a lot more about nonprofits versus one that doesn't?
I think it's all about changing industries, and a good smart accountant can absolutely figure it out eventually. And some of the stuff, a lot of the skills are transferable, right? Whether it's 60, 70, 80%. And some of it's also, are they in a leadership position or in a support position? Mm-hmm. If they're in a support position, it's 90 to 100% transferable. But when you were talking about that person who's in the main leadership administrative accounting role, those differences can get to be important. And so one of those is organizational culture and just understanding that nonprofits there's a default kind of culture. It's not universal, but usually there are many commonalities that a nonprofit, small nonprofit, especially smaller midsize, will have in their culture that makes them usually different from other organizations, just like an oil and gas organization is probably going to have a very different culture from an organization that's in the entertainment business. And that those cultural differences, if you're blind to them, then there are a lot of landmines out there. And so you end up having folks who step on what can be really big landmines, like saying something that suggests to their coworkers that profit is more important to them than mission. You never want to say that to a nonprofiteer because you lose all your credibility. You also don't want to say anything that suggests that you value profit over people, because again, you'll lose all your credibility and they won't want to play with you anymore. Vocabulary choices can make a difference. If you go in and start talking to a nonprofit and you start throwing phrases out there like, well, your company, blah, 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 or your business, they're going to immediately say, this person doesn't get us. They don't understand us. And they're going to mentally walk away, if not physically walk away. And on a similar note, something that I've seen happen way too often, folks will come from outside the nonprofit world and they'll start doing what we call biz-splaining, which is kind of like going in and saying, in the businesses that I've run, we blah, 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 and your nonprofit should do blah, 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 blah. That doesn't mean that that person is wrong in terms of that information and that identifying that thing. But if they go in and say it in that way, they're going to lose, again, all their credibility instead of putting themselves in a position where, you person who is coming in from the outside, You do have some really good things to say, some insights for us, but it's kind of like that spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. And knowing how to apply that spoonful of sugar so the nonprofit will embrace that, what feels like a big, bold, crazy change, that's what somebody with a few years of nonprofit leadership experience under their belt can really do, and where somebody without it can hit some really big landmines. And then there's what you just mentioned, right? Like understanding the relevant federal regulations. And if you get grants, there's all the reporting stuff that goes along with that.
Yeah.
And understanding risk aversion and the overhead myth. Those are things that, if those are blind spots for you, wanting to transition over into the nonprofit sector, and I've even written a blog about this for anybody that is thinking about making that switch, you can make the switch, but the more you understand your blind spots, the more that you are can set yourself up for success in that organization at the job interview stage, but also during your first 6-12 months while you're figuring out what makes this different from those for-profits that you've been serving.
When it comes to, I know the fixed costs are a big deal, unrestricted costs are a big deal. What have you found that is a misnomer in regards to, let's say, in this case, what the government would say is, like, just give me one or two things that you found that unrestricted reimbursement is a misnomer, that people are making mistakes when they think that, you know, that only salaries are included in that?
Yeah, they're... You know, every funder is going to be different. And so part of the whole thing is really like understanding your funder and where they're coming from and what some are going to allow you to charge to the grant. Others won't, or some will allow it, but the way you present it can be important, or just kind of jumping through hoops, like getting that negotiated indirect cost rate agreement in place. You know, I heard recently from somebody who's one of the top people in the field, and when it comes to the NICROs, and he said, you know, and he used to be on the government side of it, and he was telling us, you know, the folks on the government side of it, they want you to be able to get every single penny that you're entitled to. They want you to be able to understand the cost, but they need it to come in this certain way. And if you can do that, then great. We're going to approve it. And it, you know, the important thing for us is we want you to be able to get the work done, and we want it to be sustainable for your nonprofit. But they need it in a certain way. And so, yeah, understanding each funder can be really important, and not trying to, you know, there are sometimes that folks think, oh, we need to have more sources of revenue for a nonprofit is better. And you know, I finally got like some good data on that. And the best data that I've seen, and this is again from somebody who knows more about this than I do, is that actually having two big revenue sources is the best mix so that you can really understand how they work. And so whether that's individual contributions or government grants or foundation grants or earned revenue, because you just can't be a jack of all trades, but getting really good at two of those can be the best revenue mix, rather than, because you can't be good at 10 different kinds of revenue, which some organizations mistakenly try to do, and then they end up doing a mediocre job at all of them.
So I would assume that if you're working with a client and you want to look at unrestricted costs, you read the contract of the source and, or not, you know, the funder, and what does it usually say about how they calculate that?
Well, a lot of times when it comes to things like administrative costs and whatnot, certainly like fundraising and marketing is typically out. A grantor will rarely want to cover those unless it is like marketing that is specific to the project they're funding. And it's like getting the word out because we want to do a literacy program and we want to get this community to actually come to our literacy event. That would be allowable, but just general, like, hey, come donate to our literacy foundation would not be allowable. And then similarly, administratively, some of them can be fairly loose and flexible. Some of them might want to just say, you know what, we're just going to let you take a flat percentage and you don't need to justify it to us. The bigger ones, and especially the government, they're going to want to be able to come in and get receipts. And if you get a government grant, I think the threshold is $750,000. If you go over that threshold, they're not only going to want you to show receipts and show timesheets and you only spend in approved categories, but they're going to want to be able to come in and do a fairly invasive audit. And so certainly a good nonprofit is going to really be well prepared for that. And be careful before taking that money, because when you sign that grant agreement, you are agreeing to get reimbursed at a certain rate. And can you afford that? Or is what they're allowing you to do actually allowing you to cover all of your administrative and indirect costs? Or are you going to have to subsidize it? Is your fundraising team going to need to be able to come up with another $100,000 to be able to cover this really great $2 million government grant that's going to really help your programs? Because if not, and if your fundraising team can't come up with that money, then what you in effect are doing is you're stretching your accounting and administrative team really thin. And that's not sustainable either. And even if they can do it for a year or 2 years, eventually that's the kind of thing that's going to lead to burnout and breakage. And that's when it gets really, really, really expensive. Fixing an organization once that function is broken is super expensive.
When you've been involved with audits, a government audit, is it more than a 50% chance that they're going to find something that's a real problem, or is it how strict are they?
So I've had the very good fortune of never have been being in the driver's seat on those, but plenty of people on my team have, and I get to hear from them regularly and get to talk to clients about it. And certainly a lot of it will depend on which government agency it is and which particular person's coming in. I just heard from an old client the engagement ended a couple of years ago, but they're getting audited right now about work that we did with them. And apparently this particular auditor, I isn't dotted, if a T isn't crossed, they're in a world of hurt. And so this particular auditor seems to actually be hostile. And whereas others can be very much the opposite, where, you know what, as long as this, and again, a lot of it will depend on the degree of kind of what the auditor finds. But if it's, you know, if it's an I not getting dotted or a T getting crossed, if it's kind of like an innocent mistake, if there's been a change in personnel, then, you know, the friendlier auditors and the ones that really try to take a balanced role are going to say, you know what, this happened and we're going to write it up, but you know what, we're not going to penalize you for it, but then just make sure that this doesn't happen again. You know, my bosses will let you have a pass one time. They won't let you have a pass again. And so I'm going to put this in big, bold letters, but there's not going to be any immediate penalty for you. And so certainly a good way that a nonprofit can help themselves out with this. Some organizations will belong to a state or nationwide organization of peer organizations. That's a great way to kind of get the lay of the land and figure out, oh yeah, like cross your fingers and pray that this person is going to be your auditor and not their coworker. Or that sometimes that organization can go and advocate on your behalf, or even if there's not an official organization, putting yourself in touch and creating an informal network of peers so that you can reach out and say, oh my gosh, how did you navigate this? And how did you navigate that? It can be helpful with the government grants, but also those peer relationships can be helpful navigating so many things, whether you are a nonprofit accounting leader or the executive director or in any of those leadership seats. Those relationships are more than worth their weight in gold.
I would imagine that as organizations are growing, that you know, when they're smaller, they're not as organized when it comes to their record keeping, and that once you get to a certain point in revenue is only the time when you start to, you know, kind of bear down on processes, record keeping, and those type of things. Has that been your experience as well?
I think that's, it doesn't have to be that way. And some of it is certainly like luck of the draw, like who is your first administrative staffer that you hire? And are they detail oriented? And are they naturally a person who is going to create systems, or is that not their jam and their default setting? But certainly as a general rule in terms of what we find, the larger the organization, the more likely they are to have those things more organized, sometimes because they're more likely to have a critical mass of staff in charge of those things and with the experience and whatnot to know that, yeah, we can't just take all the paperwork and shove it in a drawer and hope for good things. Or sometimes they've gotten dinged, you know, and it's like, well, yeah, we had a funder threaten to take away our grant if we didn't get our act together. And so we worked for 4 weekends in a row to pull it all together. And we're never going to let that happen again.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you a very detail oriented question. I mean, we had an advertiser on this podcast, who had software that was specifically built for small to medium size nonprofits. And one of the things I had always said was, if you're using QuickBooks, you probably should consider using a accounting package that's just specifically built for nonprofits. Has it been your experience that is a true statement, that QuickBooks doesn't do a great job of managing a nonprofit accounting needs versus software specifically built for nonprofits?
I was wondering if you were going to ask this question. I've been listening to some of the other podcasts you've done and definitely picked up on this. I think it depends. I wouldn't say that there's an easy answer. Like, certainly, I agree that all other things being equal, having something that's specifically designed to your organization, your needs, and the way you work is going to be it's going to be better than something that's sort of generically good. But, you know, every small and mid-sized nonprofit, there are lots of differences between them. One of the main things that unites them is kind of their tax status. And so you can have, you know, small nonprofits that kind of function like almost like a venture capital kind of organization. I've been in conversations with one of them right now. Another might be working on animal welfare. Another one might be working on the environment. And so they're all going to have different needs. And so certainly, like, what does it mean that those folks think that they designed their software exquisitely for kind of all nonprofits? But certainly, how well does QuickBooks work for small, mid-sized nonprofits? In my experience, it works. It has a lot of advantages, and some of them are just come from market dominance. They have something like 80% or more of the small business and small nonprofit market in the United States, which gives them certain advantages. Like, it's really easy to find somebody who's experienced with it. And it's really easy to find a lot of great online videos and chat rooms and just peers that you can call on. And also, QuickBooks, you can get it for almost free as a nonprofit. You can get it almost free through TechSoup. And so, like, if I had a nonprofit come to me and they said, you know, we need an accounting solution, I think it'd be a really valid to say, yeah, you know what? Look at, you know, any solution that says they are exquisitely designed for nonprofits, absolutely have them at the table and also have QuickBooks at the table and really do the compare and contrast. Because whether or not, you know, one is the right match for the other, that's a lot of it's going to depend on you as an organization and what things are most important. Like, I can tell you, QuickBooks is number one competitor, Xero. We have a client who, you know, we had to go back to them and recommend, you know, even though Xero is like the number two cloud accounting software, it is not anywhere near adequate to their needs, whereas what they do need, QuickBooks has the things that it does need. And so it can be really hard also to kind of have all the stuff that an organization would need. And so like, can Xero be the right solution for some nonprofits? Yeah. Can the your sponsor be the right solution for some? Absolutely, have them at the table. And I'm sure it's going to be the right and the best solution for some. But QuickBooks is also going to be the right solution for some. And so taking the time to compare those things. And when you have to do research like this, you know, sometimes you want to bring in an accounting professional to help you out if you don't have anybody on staff or among your like trusted big volunteers, like your treasurer or whatnot. Sometimes even a smart intern can help you do some of the kicking of the tires and like, you know, here are the 20 different things that we need to compare these different options on. And, you know, because I'm a nonprofit leader and this is not my area of expertise. So I'm getting information from all different sides. And some people are even telling me QuickBooks desktop, that's rarely going to be, for a handful of folks, it's going to be the right solution, but it's also a product that's getting nails put in the coffin every day. But by all means, like have those at the table and do a good matrix and a compare and contrast. And that's the best way to make sure you're getting the right solution.
I like that. I think the reason why I know the reason why I had said, you know, kind of go with an industry that's in your industry is because I've had, you know, 30 years of experience of selecting software. And what I've found is when you go with a software that's not really built for your industry versus software specifically built for your industry, you get all this other stuff, and it's knowledge based of them knowing what you either need now or going to need. So it's like somebody coming in who's an expert in nonprofits and says, you're going to need this, you're going to need this. And I saw that specifically with, you know, I went with CRM software, which was Microsoft at first. And then I moved to a specialized CRM software called Velocify. And oh man, they gave me things that I didn't even think I knew I needed. And I was like, oh, it can do this, it can do that. So it was built in processes. I mean, so I think, you know, that was why I often said, you know, the company that I was advertising us was called Arrays. And I think they're cheap. They're like $30 a month, you know, for a small nonprofit. So
it's really affordable.
Yeah, it's very affordable. And, you know, and they've been around for a long time. And, but they also had like the fundraising and integrated involved in it, the CRM, you know, it's customer relationship management built into it. So, you know, I don't think you don't just buy, having all these other things was I think very, very valuable. I know one of the organizations that I was involved with switched to it and they were happy. So, what about, have you had any situations where organizations got bigger and the board said, we need some more help on, having tighter financial controls. I mean, outside of the typical accounting work, you know, what are some things that you see are very common that people will bring you on board for?
So more often than not, it'll be the executive directors that reach out to us rather than the board. If the board reaches out to us, it means there's probably either they're a really small nonprofit and so they may not have executive director level staff, or there's probably a big problem because by the time you get big enough to where there's probably a good match between a potential client and us, the executive director should probably be in the driver's seat on that kind of stuff as a default in most cases. I'm sorry. I went down a rabbit hole and I forgot your original question.
Well, it was about like, does the board bring you in? But you said, no, not usually. Yeah. Like what other things do they typically bring you in for outside of just, you know, we need, you know, someone to manage the books better, or we have this issue. Okay. You know, what is a little bit more outside of just the day-to-day operational accounting stuff?
Yeah, well, sometimes it is probably about a third to half of the clients come to us because something's on fire. And we're happy to help at that time. By the time it catches on fire, it is a lot more expensive for them, which breaks our heart a little bit, but we're still there to help them. But the rest of the clients, it's because they're looking ahead. Either they've had like some small pain points and they want to get out ahead of them, or they're thinking, this isn't a problem yet, but we want to double in size over the next 24 months. And we know that what got us here ain't going to get us there. And they know that they don't have the expertise in house. And so how can we up our game in terms of our accounting administrative backbone? Because they recognize that behind every successful nonprofit, you're going to find a strong back office. And so making sure that they have that strong back office and that strong accounting function so that even if they double or triple in size, they have a clean bill of health, right? That just like, if you've never run or you haven't run in 10 years, you want to go to your doctor and say, I'm thinking about doing the Ironman thing. I set that as a bucket list thing and I want to go do that in 3 years. And doctor's going to start telling you, all right, let's change your diet and don't go and try and run the New York Marathon today, right? Let's build that up. And similarly, we would work with the organization to make sure that they have not just the structures they need today, but to really get the strong structures in place for tomorrow. That can include such things as, if you've not had a meaningful number of federal grants, and that's the revenue stream that you want to develop and make that your really biggest revenue stream within 3 years, QuickBooks probably isn't going to cut it anymore at that point. QuickBooks will let you muddle through some of those, but if you're getting millions and millions in government grants, the recording requirements are such that you need something more. Or let's look at your accounting staff. Right now you have a bookkeeper who is also your managed IT person, who's also your HR person, and they wear all these other hats. That person, no matter how much they love the mission, and maybe they don't have a life outside of work, and so they don't mind working long hours and this, that, and the other, but this will break them, right? And so how do we set things up so that that person is in the right seat on the bus, right? That might be that person may or may not have like strong leadership potential to lead in a organization that's three times the size. So let's figure that out. What's their seat on the bus? What other seats do we need to add to the bus? What internal controls do we need that we don't have already? Are the current internal controls strong? Getting those in place, processes and procedures. What works really well in a mom and pop sized operation can break and not work well in a bigger organization. So, do we need to get some of your processes, automate those, right? Bring in a service like bill.com so that you don't have all these paper processes that worked well enough when you only had 20 transactions a month, but aren't going to work when you have 200 transactions a month.
Hmm. Those sorts of things. Bill.com works with nonprofits?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're agnostic as to the tax status.
Yeah. I agree with you. I mean, I think moving to the right, I think one of the things the executive directors, if you're a founder, you have to think about, even if you're not a founder, is can this organization run without me? And because eventually you're not going to be there, right? And when you start thinking that way, because you know why I say that is, well, a lot of times executive directors and founders, sometimes they're doing the accounting work too, right?
Yes, and they are.
Yeah. And so, if something happens and you're not working, I mean, can that organization run when you go on vacation for 10 days? And yes, you should be going on vacation. Do you have to check into the office? Do you have to continue to do the accounting work? Do you get back from your vacation? And I know what people are saying. Well, I don't go on vacation. So, I'm saying about them, not me. But when you come back from vacation, is there tons of things that you have to do? One of them, accounting. That is not a good way to run an organization.
It's hard to not have that as a part of it. Like when it's very, very small, it kind of all does depend on the founder, executive director. But I agree with you 100%. as quickly as possible, an executive director should figure out how the organization lives beyond them, right? If their aspiration is for the organization to live beyond them, they need to be very intentional about it and have a succession plan in place. If that's not really a priority for the person, you know, they can still do great work in the world, but it's so much better if you set the organization up so that it can outlive you, whether you, you know, just have a change in interests or you have a life event or whatever, and you can no longer be in that role. And I'm going to take this a step further, Stephen, and say the same thing is true for your accounting and your financial leadership. Because again, it's that whole, if you wait until something breaks or that person retires suddenly, burnout, has an anvil fall out of the sky as if it were a Looney Tunes cartoon, whatever it is, that's just the organization's in a world of hurt, and really quickly bad things happen, right? You can't miss payroll very many times and not have cascading effects. But not only that, when those folks in that seat don't take vacation, it contributes to burnout and whatnot. And it's actually one of the biggest red flags for fraud. You want to have a couple of times a year somebody who is not the regular person that does payroll and bill paying. You want to have somebody else in the organization at least a couple of times a year sitting in that seat and doing those functions. Part of that's because you're decent people. And if that accounting lead, that payroll person, someday they may need to be in the hospital with a loved one who's in a world of hurt. And you don't want to be the jerk who calls them up and says, you know, can you run payroll for us while you're sitting next to your loved one in the hospital, right? Or ask them to come in and do it. But also when somebody else just touches those functions a couple of times a year, that's going to make it a whole lot harder for somebody to give into the temptation of ever doing fraud, because somebody's going to be looking at this work and they might stumble upon it. Maybe I should think twice before committing fraud. But also if they do make bad choices, and anybody can make bad choices given some just unfortunate life circumstances, any human being, we can give into temptation. So having somebody else do it a couple of times a year means that it is more likely to get caught. And also by doing that, by forcing that person to take vacation, they're less likely to get burned out. And also it forces them to document their key processes. And when those are documented, so many other good things can happen. That person can take vacation and not worry about it, not time it around payroll. And, you know, I can only take 5 days off because we run payroll weekly, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I would add two things that from my experience too. Number one is fraud is much higher than you think it is. So I think you got to be, nonprofit leaders are very incredibly giving people, and they don't want to think that way. I know I don't like thinking that way, but, you know, that someone's going to do fraud, and, you know, and that's, I think you'd be surprised what someone would think is fraud and not fraud, you know? So I think that's number one. Number two is, certainly as your organization grows, you should be thinking about duplication of jobs. If somebody is going to be out for an extended period of time, who else knows about what they're doing and who else can do the work? Because I'll tell you what happens. You start growing. All of a sudden, somebody who's pretty critical to your organization either leaves or is incapacitated in some regards. And then you're up, you know, a creek, right? And then you start realizing, oh, I don't want this to happen again. So you really need to look at those critical functions like accounting. And I had fractional CFOs, and you know what that means is a part-time CFO, who just made sure that we were doing the right things. You know, if you're small, maybe you can have them on for an hour or two once a quarter. Then they make sure we're doing things right from the very beginning. And they know my operation, and they could be my duplicate if something ever happens. And, you know, or to make sure that I have that in the back of my head, okay, this is the type of reports I should be looking at. This is what the board should be reviewing. That way I have a good familiarity with what's going on in our accounting and financial situation. All fair.
Oh yeah, I agree 100%, and I think you're especially right on that piece of advice where having that pre-existing relationship with a fractional CFO can be really important. Even if like the routine of that is they're just in with you for a few hours a month, when you as a nonprofit, when you're out shopping for fractional CFOs, in addition to all the other kind of kicking of the tires that you should do to make sure this person is not just qualified but a good match for you, but as you're suggesting, Stephen, making sure that they are connected to a team so that if your nonprofit experiences an emergency, are they in a position where they or other people in their organization can come in and respond to a sudden need? Like if you lose your full-time accountant, who's your whole accounting department, is this fractional CFO in a position where they or somebody else that they work with, they can quickly help you cover things? Because that's a big advantage, right? They already know the organization. They know how to plug things in. They know how things work. But if they don't have those connections, and if really their thing is, no, I can only ever do, 10 hours a month for you, and that's it, even if you have a surge need, then that may not be the right person. Ideally, your fractional CFO is somebody who can put on the fireman hat when necessary.
Yeah. Well, listen, and let me just make sure. I mean, I've talked a lot about having CFO and your role. We have no financial, you and I, arrangement here. You're on as a guest. Yes. And I just am a big proponent of you having the right type of software, the right type of a help. And you don't always need to have a full-time person that you hire. You can use, in the last 10 to 15 years, it's about using free agents and contractors, especially as you're growing, not having to deal with the worry that someone could leave you is a big problem, And so, with a contractor, they're typically not going to leave you, So, great podcast today. We covered a lot. I think there's a lot of things that can be talked about in regards to this accounting area, but we've covered it well. I'd like to thank so very much Sean Hale from Nonprofit CFOs for coming on today's podcast. And if you like today's podcast or any of the other podcasts, please feel free to give us a 5-star rating. It really helps us expand our listenership. And if you like today's podcast also, just recommend to friends. And of course, if you're looking for a line of credit for your organization, please feel free to visit our website at nonprofitmbapodcast.com. Sean, if anyone wants to get in touch with you, how would they go about doing that?
The best place would be to go right to our website, nonprofitcfos.com. It's our shiny, brand new website.
Great. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you, Stephen. It's been a real pleasure. And thank you for everything you're doing. I've seen a lot of nonprofit podcasts. Yours is the one that I've seen that really makes an effort to cover the administrative and accounting side of things that all too often gets forgotten. And you're doing a great job of really helping to elevate that and say, this is necessary. This is worthy of attention in order to have a healthy, successful, high impact nonprofit. So,
well, thank you for saying
the good work.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. We have great guests. I mean, really, it's always interesting. On top of that, I'd like to not just thank you for listening, our listeners, but just to remind you that you guys are out there, making a huge difference in this world. I thank you for that. I know Sean thanks you for that. But you can't make a big difference in this world if you don't think about yourself first. You need to make sure that you are, keeping yourself healthy and mentally and physically, because saving the world takes a lot. It takes a lot out of you. And you're no good to your employees, you're no good to your cause, you're no good to your family, your friends, and even yourself if you don't really think about how to take care of yourself so that you can do the hard lifting of saving the world. And we certainly Amen. Need to, right? So make sure you're thinking about every day, what do you need to do to be at your best today? And I'm sure you know what that is. Stop thinking about everybody else. Think about yourself first, and then you'll be able to run this marathon instead of this sprint. So other than that, have a great day, everybody. And thank you for listening to the Nonprofit MBA Podcast.